Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 440. And yes, it's a biggie. I'm joined today by Mr. Stephen Fry. I mean, what more can I say? Need I say more? I mean, I will. I'm going to say more. But yeah, obviously I was hugely excited to have Stephen on. And you're going to find out that he very much delivered. We've been, as we'll discuss, we've been lining this up for a while, but it was more than worth the wait. I think you're going to really enjoy it. If this is your first time tuning in, first of all, you can have a full welcome here, but check out the back catalogue. Previous guests include everyone from Louis Theroux to Mary J. Blige, John Ronson to, I don't know, Spike Lee, Florence Pugh, James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, Stuart Lee, Richard Herring, Adam Buxton, Joe Cornish, Sarah Pascoe, Ashlyn B, Elena Heady, loads of amazing people, basically. Dizzy Rascal. Yeah, there's been a variation, as you can tell. I'm going to get into the podcast relatively quickly because I'm as excited as you are, guys. But before I do, I want to tell you that I'm going to start streaming on Twitch soon. I know I've been teasing it for a long time now. I've had a Twitch channel for ages, and I mainly watch people. I watch previous guest Blind Boy, and previous guest Limmy, and previous guest David Earl, and previous guest Dan Lesak. These are all people I watch on Twitch, and a few of them have given me some tips and some advice, and I'm going to be starting up soon. I may or may not be doing something that involves Limmy and being part of something he's been doing. Genuinely, that's still to be decided as I record this, but I wanted to tease it with you. And what I mainly want to say is head over to twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio and give me a follow. Because, yeah, I've been wanting to stream on there for a while, but I've always kind of put it off and thought, oh, nah, there's no interest or whatever. So it's been really nice to see the page getting a bit of a following before I've even streamed. And it's kind of, that's played a large part in what's given me the confidence to kind of go, all right, well, let's give that a go. I'll probably be streaming some playing of games, some DJing, potentially, terms of service allowing. Might do some chat, might jump on there and do some little mini podcasts, who knows? But tons of stuff that might be of interest. If you're not familiar, Twitch is a streaming platform. So, yeah, get over there and give me a follow if you would. Let's get on with the podcast. As ever, we're brought to you by speechdevelopment.com and patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. That's where you can get my merch or support the podcast on Patreon. But I won't go on about that too long because I've just rambled on about Twitch to you for about a minute. This was a joy, you know, to go from 10, 15 years ago, from Thou Shalt Not Question Stephen Fry, to Thou Shalt Jump on Zoom and quite literally question Stephen Fry. I'm joined today by the national treasure himself, Mr. Stephen Fry. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you, Pip. Very well indeed, and delighted to be talking to you because, as we can tell your listeners, it's been a few years that I've had to put off, I think, at least three times by very bad luck our meeting.
But all for really good reasons, yeah, as well. So I'm delighted that we're here now, and I want to talk about a lot of things. Again, I want to just start off by just, yes, seeing how you are. It's been strange times, hasn't it, I guess? So where are you at the moment in mentally and so on and so forth?
Well, pretty good, thanks, Pip. I mean, you know, I've got so much less to complain about than many others. I've got a kind of security as far as work is concerned. And even though this pandemic has hit so many people in our business, music and performing arts and so on, I have the good fortune that I have a lot to do in writing terms, which you only need a pen, pencil, keyboard, screen, and audiobooks and recordings of various things. And I have a little sort of voice booth sound studio at my house in Norfolk. So I've been able, over the past 2 years, I think I did in the first year of lockdown, 25 audiobooks, for example. Wow. So that was a nice thing. It just kept me balanced and reasonably sane to pop down. I could go literally in my pyjamas first thing in the morning and, you know, just have something to do and feel not quite wasted. I think that's the problem.
I love it. I think it's this sanity part as much as anything else on those things. I moved into acting a few years back, and quite soon into that I was encouraged to start writing my own scripts. And that has been a godsend in this pandemic, because I've just been able to go, right, I'm just going to work on scripts. No idea if any of them will ever go anywhere, but I get to be creative and I get to express my thoughts and ideas and feel worth, as strange as it sounds. I think everyone in the creative arts, we have had to face how much of our worth is put on audiences, which is a scary thing. And suddenly you're like, well, who am I? If I'm not in front of anyone, am I a Scroobius Pip? Am I am I David Meads? Who am I? What is this?
That's the way we keep score, isn't it? And the number of laughs, the number of people who come to the theatres and the venues, the number of clicks, the number of everybody these days is in some way, their value and their fulfilment and their sense of themselves seems to be represented by a metric. Likes, favorites, followers, all those kind of things, which are something we're more used to perhaps in show business, because that's how many people have booked tickets, you know, is precisely that. And it goes all the way back to our sense of inadequacy and horror and shame and loneliness in the schoolyard when we felt we were unpopular or we weren't asked to join that gang, you know. We never lose that. It seems to be a deep part of being human, and technology and the shrinkage of human interaction that the pandemic caused seems to have exacerbated that, I guess. And that does have you mentioned mental health as well, and that does unquestionably for lots of people, particularly the young, seem to have a real blowback as far as just ease is concerned. I like using the word ease because we use disease a lot as a word, and it's sort of almost lost its sense of being coupled to the word ease.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say contentment or happiness. They're almost too much to ask for in life, aren't they?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
just a bit of ease, you know, which is kind of freedom from anxiety and stress. We're never going to be free of those things, but a kind of averagely free time from those, if you like.
Yeah, completely. What's kind of your relationship with social media these days, because you've touched upon the kind of the gamification of our lives. We're collecting gold coins in likes or follows or retweets and things like that, so we have kind of subconsciously turned so much of our lives into a computer game. But you were very much an early adopter of Twitter. It was seeing you on there that made me go, I'm going to give that one a look. So
I do apologise.
You were there from the early days. You can't be held responsible for all that's happened on Twitter since then. But how's your relationship developed with it, I guess, in the changes of its and iterations of it over the years?
Well, there's been a lot of hot and cold. I've left a couple of times in ways which have had me alternately described as storming off or throwing my toys out of the pram or whatever. But yes, I am a ridiculously sensitive person. I do like to please people, and if I find sort of evidence of snarly, you know, meanness, it just breaks me, and I have to run away from it, really. Yeah. So on a couple of occasions I've done that, but what I'm really come to now is that, for me at least, Twitter is something where you contribute, but you don't absorb anybody else's contributions, which is a bit unfair and a bit one-sided. But if you think of it as like a notice board, for me it's a notice board. If I've got a book out or a TV show or a film or whatever it might be, or something I want to share that I think is important in some way, I will put it up on the notice board. I get out my four drawing pins and put it up like the school notice boards, you know, the headmaster's notice, the games notice, the drama club notice board. I put it up and I walk away. What I don't do is wait to see all the others clustering around it going, what's he put up? What's he? Oh, that's pathetic. So I try not to read anything that is, you know, below the line, as it were, like on YouTube. Yeah. I regard it as like looking below the street level in life, where all there is the sewerage system. And that's what the comments pages are.
I've very much got in the habit of posting anything that I have to post, either just before I start recording a podcast or just before I do a workout. So there isn't that temptation, at least for that first hour, to be checking and seeing responses, being able to go, it's there.
Yep.
Now I'm not even tempted because I'm busy with something else, because I think I'm too addicted. I get drawn into the, are people enjoying this? Are people paying attention? And it's
what's so sad about it is that really a huge percentage of people are very, very fine. They're witty. They're worth listening to. They have interesting ideas, interesting responses. They represent the best of humanity. It's just, I mean, the image I've drawn before in the past is that when Twitter started, and indeed the whole internet, really, I thought of it as like being a marvelous outdoor swimming pool, like a Lido or something, you know, and you would just arrive and you'd dive in and you'd make friends and it was wonderful. And then, well, it doesn't matter how pure the water is. If it's 99% pure, but if there's a turd floating in the corner, you're going to get out. And what happened with Twitter was the weeds grew up from the bottom, and the broken glass and the old prams and the rubbish filled up, and the water began to stink. And it is always unfair on the good and the wise and the kind, but one just has to just walk away from that kind of venomous atmosphere. It's not good for one. It's not good for those who spend their life spewing out that poison either. I mean, they're the ones one should feel most sorry for, really, because it's a sign of a deeply flawed and unhappy and life, a kind of outsider life, a feeling of not being connected. And that's something we all have. And there are different ways of responding to it, aren't there? You can feel everyone else has somehow got the memo. Everyone else had that lesson about how to do everything from dancing in a nightclub to, you know, being relaxed and picking up potential partners and being picked up and, you know, the learning the dance of human life. And some of us always felt we just missed out on that lesson. Yeah. We must have had a dental appointment that afternoon or something while everyone else. And the result is either to feel lonely and bitter and estranged and annoyed by it. And the other is to sort of take up often preposterous, I suppose, artistic, revolutionary, outsider pose that you want to be outside. You're like Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment or whatever, you know, the immoralist in Gide or the outsider, indeed, in Albert Camus. You know, this kind of figure, I'm better. I don't want to be part of this muddy tribe, this mob of rugby-playing yahoos, and, you know. And if one's honest, I think most of us have a feeling of both, that we want to be apart from the mob and we want to be a part of the mob.
I completely relate, particularly when you were speaking there of using the analogy of comfort in going and dancing and going and things like that. I was talking to a friend last weekend about an incident that happened a few years ago. I was at a friend's birthday party, and I don't particularly drink much these days. It's not because of any addiction or issues, it's just I just choose not to. But equally, really very much sober, I will not be getting on a dance floor. There is not a chance. But you know, I'm comfortable with that. And then at this party, unexpectedly to me, the actor Channing Tatum appeared,
who
I just think is incredibly cool. I'm kind of in awe of, and he was having a good dance, and I thought, I really want he was dancing with a load of my mates. So I was like, I really want to dance with Channing Tatum. So I rushed to the bar and ordered 3 or 4 drinks because I had to quickly get to a level that I was comfortable doing something I wanted to do. I wanted to go and engage in this.
That's brilliant. My night with Channing should be a little short story or something, shouldn't it?
100%. He's going to be completely unaware it ever happened.
I bet he was a good dancer as well, because he's obviously very physical. He played
a
wrestler. A
wonderful dancer. Exactly. Well, I mean, I want to speak about our initial connection, because it'd be crazy not to. When at one point Our connection in person was when Phil Jupitus invited me along to a recording of QI. And I didn't know if you'd be aware of me or of a particular line in one of my songs. And you greeted me with such warmth and excitement because of, Thou Shalt Not Question Stephen Fry, which was a key part of my first ever single that got in the top 40 and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it had got to you, and it was a positive.
It had got to me, and of course, with typical and absurd human paranoia, I at first wondered whether it was ironic, and thought, and then I thought, well, it's just charming. I just love it. It's even if it is ironic, that it's somehow perfect. And so I was delighted to meet you and very pleased to be in what was a wonderful number and a great song, I have to say. So, I mean, if you're going to be quoted, at least be quoted or mentioned in a top piece of work. And I felt that I was.
And speaking of quotes, the amount of people who went on to get Thou Shalt Not Question Stephen Fry tattooed on their person, often on several people on their bottom, but numerous different places. I remember having one picture shared by a young lady that she had to crop very carefully because it was very much just the top end of the pelvic kind of bone. So yeah, it's been a popular one.
That's lovely to know, especially as we're living in the shadow. I don't know if you saw it. Someone. Times journalist called Melanie Phillips wrote this article saying that she was physically revolted by, felt nothing but revulsion, I think was the phrase, by tattoos. And it's caused this sort of outrage,
right,
which is a common thing these days, as we know. And it's got a lot of people thinking about tattoos. It's unquestionable, I think, that tattoos have become a big thing, a much bigger thing than they were when I was young. When I was young, you know, it was sailors very often had tattoos. You know, you think of Popeye with his anchor. And, you know, sort of labourers, and it was a blue collar, as they'd say in America, thing. But now I've got godchildren who've got them, and good friends who said, oh, I'm going to have a butterfly in the small of my back just to start off. And then they get more and more. And it's interesting. I mean, I think religious people have always hated it because it's almost as if, I mean, it's in the Bible specifically, I think, as a taboo. It's non-kosher for Jewish people to have a tattoo. And it's almost as if you are denying the supremacy of what is laid down by religion if you decide to do what you like with your own body.
Yeah, you're adapting God's perfect creation, I guess.
Exactly. And which it has held in the West, but of course, I mean, I think what Melanie Phillips didn't think through was the people of the South Pacific and the Maori people and all kinds of people around the world, in Africa and in Australia and elsewhere, for whom body art and piercing and tattooing and a whole range of different sort of alterations are hugely important and quasi-religious, really, have a sort of spiritual as well as an obvious physical meaning. And I almost thought, when I read her article, which I thought was absolutely repellent, I thought, she's basically forcing me to have one, because I'm going to have to choose a side now. After 64 years, am I going to get my first ink? And I haven't quite decided yet.
And my dad got his first tattoo, and I think it was his 60th birthday, and it was because his mum had always said, you can't get a tattoo, what will it look like when you're 60? So when he was 60, he got a tattoo to go, there you go.
Very
good. It looks great. It looks fine.
It's less likely to sag.
Yes, exactly. It's really interesting that I think so many of our moral outrage and arguments is so framed by such small areas. And we've seen it a lot in the pandemic, but an easy example I found when doing some research on it was on gender politics and realising that so many cultures have had more than two genders for the entirety of their history, yet we're absolutely very much, it's a modern thing and we're trying to change, people are trying to change what's true. And it's like, no, there's two genders is a modern thing.
You're so right.
It's the opposite.
It is one of the ironies of this kind of culture war exchange that It is those who are upset by and regard it as just wokeness or, you know, cultural Marxism or whatever else they want to call it. They're the ones who are most ignorant of history.
Yeah.
they say, oh, they're trying to airbrush history by pulling down this statue. No, we're trying to highlight history. We're trying to show what the true history of a thing is, what it bears, what language bears, what icons and statuary and images bear, and what our kind of story on humanity, what it really has as a history, and how recent so much that we take to be absolute, in fact, is. And it's a very good example. You talk about, you know, gender and so on. The Greeks had a very open sense of a third gender, and of obviously they created the character of Hermaphroditus.
And
this was a very holy and sacred thing. It was really the Romans who didn't like that. The Romans had a virile, militaristic. They were fascists, literally fascists. I mean, the word fascist comes from the Roman symbol for power, the fasces, which is an axe with a bundle of rod tied in it, which they would carry in their parades, their marches. And that fasces was a symbol of the power of the military and of the authorities over whom all Romans essentially had to subjugate their own will. And that's what fascism means, really, the worship of and the imposition of power, Macht, that in German, might. And so they got rid of a lot of the nuance of Greek mythology and the Greek way of looking at the world. They kept Greeks really in their empire because they'd subjugated Greece. They kept Greeks as doctors because they recognized the scientific superiority of much of Greek thought. And philosophers in, you know, Stoicism moved over to Rome. But real thinking and spiritualism and mythology and a kind of openness to human, the ambiguity of being human in every sense, not just a gender sense, but in, and the Greeks understood that and played with it and found it remarkable. But the Romans preferred things to be in a straight line.
I always remember hearing that in Greek times, homosexuality was accepted, and then realizing no, it just wasn't a thing. It wasn't something that was considered
needed to be accepted.
There wasn't any acceptance. It was people did what they desired as such, rather than does that mean you're straight or gay or bi or, you know, all these other labels.
Yes, it would be like saying people with blue eyes were accepted. It's just that's it is. And of course, there was a culture of and a sort of known culture of gay relationships. But yes, and not just, and Greece is, you know, the European part, and we often regard as the centre or the sort of the fount of our own civilization. But in the South Pacific again, there's a great tradition in Tahiti, those sort of areas of a whole class of, not quite intersex, but a kind of, there's a word, and they're held as very special parts of the community. They tend, if you go to places like Tahiti, Bora Bora, whatever, you will find often in the bars there will be people waiting, serving, who it's quite hard to determine their gender by looking at them, if you look at them with Western eyes, because they adopt both, and they have this very special role as being in service, and they're much respected and much wanted. It's a, you know, it's a bit like in the old days of the Gilded Age of New York, to have an Irish concierge or porter outside your house was a sign of great, like having an English butler.
Yeah,
and similarly in the South, you know, in the South Pacific, to have these very special people is a sign of it being a proper and splendid place. They're very proud to have them, and this is repeated in various places in New Guinea and elsewhere.
I'm
not exactly full of this. I'm full of it in every sense, of course. but a couple of years ago, I was trying to get interest from a few broadcasters in a. a sort of a mixture of a history of and a world snapshot of gay culture and in how it exists in different countries.
Yeah.
You know, this idea that, I mean, I have African friends who are just so horrified by the fact that people still repeat this idea that, you know, Africa doesn't really have a gay history, or it was imported by the West. It's,
right.
It's such manifest nonsense.
Right.
And such a pity that we still have to have these arguments.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Kind of to bring elements of everything there together, from media outrage to spiritualism and religion and changing in cultures. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about or ask you about, a while back you had a fantastic quote and video that got a lot of attention, speaking against religion as such, organised religion, that if there is a God, then he allowed all of these things to happen, which I only realised when preparing for this, there was an attempt to have you arrested for blasphemy in Ireland. It's why it came to mind when you mentioned Irish there. Obviously, that all fell through. But I wanted to talk, obviously, you've gone over that in great detail, but I wanted to talk a little bit more about religion with you, because as someone who grew up, went to an all-boys Catholic school, I very much rallied against religion and was very much, it's not for me, it's the root of all evil. And it was only in later life and more recent years that I've realised how much we have to thank religious scholars for, and how there was a period that it wasn't kind of science versus religion. It was a joint thing. And again, this is another divide and rivalry, which we now see as the two opposites, that were never the case. It was kind of so much of our scientific development, our philosophical development, was rooted in religious scholars and those who were willing to look at what science can't explain, almost.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, the very practice of what is known in Bible study or as exegesis, which is the taking of a text and the poring over it and analysing it and parsing it and finding meaning in it, finding a meaningful meaning, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
And that exists, obviously, with biblical scholars in the Talmudic Jewish tradition, as well as in the later Christian tradition, and in the Islamic tradition, where there are holy texts that are pored over and analysed with this exegesis. And those tools, the tools of critical thinking that you apply even to something that might be regarded as a superstitious text, were the essential tools that were then developed into the scientific tools. And there are certain places like Cordoba in Italy and Toledo in Spain, and Toledo and other places which at particular times in the 11th century, I think I'm right in saying, held Jewish and Islamic and Christian people in the same culture, getting on with each other pretty well and cross-fertilizing with knowledge and understanding. And it was there that the first writings about optics from Muslim scientists and from Jewish and Christian thinkers too, although to call them scientists would be wrong. They were just inquirers into the nature of things, and things can include spiritual matters as well as physical matters. And as you say, there was less of a distinction drawn. The problem came, I suppose, when we look into the 17th century and Galileo and the church realizing that some of the things that were being discovered using these tools that had been developed by people like Bacon and William of Ockham and so on, these logic tools of logic and tools of inquiry, were leading to uncomfortable conclusions about the nature of the world and the cosmos, which were at odds with the Ptolemaic and Aristotelian, if one wants to give them these grand names, worldviews that had held for almost 2,000 years. And this was deeply alarming, and so they, of course, threatened to imprison, torture, put out the eyes, and so on. And religion became the enemy, if you like, of free inquiry. And that's the distinction that led to what we consider or call the Age of Reason, which in itself became perhaps the Enlightenment, so-called. And those who've always defended the Enlightenment and the Age of Reason would say that the key to it was freedom of thought. It's not where the thought went, it's that you were free to think in all directions, that you couldn't be told this was off limits by a bishop or a pope or a rabbi or an imam, that you know, this was the world we were born into, and we were free to look at it and from a mixture of reason and experience to draw conclusions about things, about the physical matter that composes our world. And if you like, also about the hierarchies and the control systems that operate in politics and monarchies and bishoprics and all the other power structures. So all of these were started to be examined, and they didn't come from one simple premise. There is a Lord God who loves us and who gave us the rules by which to live in the Bible. They start with a free premise, no prior assumptions. And it's a small logical step in a way. Okay, we'll put God to one side and just think from first principles. But the result, of course, was to some extent the overturning of religious power, if not of religious influence over people. And I personally have a huge respect and love for much of the Christian tradition. I'm actually Jewish by birth in that my mother was Jewish, but not from a religious Judaic family. But I grew up, you know, at school and things like that, with services and, you know, confirmations and communions and hymns and versicles and responses. And I loved it. I loved the music. I loved the rhythm. I loved the chanting. I loved the bells and smells, as they call it, of High Anglicanism. And I was really interested in that, the liturgical side of it, and in, as I say, the music in particular. And the only problem I had, and it was the only one, and it's the only one I still have, is that I don't actually believe in all the claims made about a creator or about his son being made flesh and so on. I think there's much good to be found in religion and in the best religious people. There's also a lot of obvious nonsense. If you look at the Bible, is, you know, a huge percentage of it is just of its own time. It's of people living in the desert who found slavery to be perfectly acceptable, and murdering children was fine, and yet, on the other hand, it was desperately important to slice off a young boy's foreskin every time he was born, and, you know, all these other peculiarities.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to stick to them is obviously bonkers, because they come from another age. And if you find yourself still cleaving to those as if they are somehow utterly essential, other than for psychological reasons, like Jewish people over the centuries celebrating Passover as a way of holding themselves together as they move from one, you know, purge and pogrom to another. So, so I'm absolutely with you. I think religion has given us a lot, and I have huge respect for... I love that there's a short story by Flaubert called A Simple Heart and Cœur Simple. And the heroine of it is this very simple maid called Felicity. And there's just an image of her kneeling in front of a stained glass window that has always stayed with me. It's a wonderful... It's where the famous Flaubert parrot comes from, because of the colour and the stained glass. But there, all the money and all the power that is represented in the stained glass, and yet from the simple heart, as it were, of Felicity kneeling there, there is a... infinitely more holiness and infinitely more beauty and infinitely more truth than in all the grandeur of the church and its pageants and its marble and its saints and its its insistence on knowing everything. That is, to me, exactly right. I would hate to mock individually pious and devout people on their knees in front of their God. It's just not my business. But the reason I got trapped into that interview in Ireland was that I was chatting away to Gay Byrne, the marvellous interviewer, the great sort of Johnny Carson of Ireland, if you like. And we were talking about all manner of things. And then at the end, he just popped in a question. Now, suppose you're wrong. Suppose after you've died, you open your eyes and there is the creator. There is God. What would you say to him? And that's when I answered. I mean, I gave what is a very old indeed, from an ancient tradition, intellectual tradition. It's called the argument from evil. Is how do you present this God that everybody you know, we all have different views of it, but the idea of the Christian God, the Jewish God, is an entirely benevolent. He loves us completely, omnipresent, omniscient, and omnipotent, so all-powerful, all-present, and all-knowing, and all-loving. And I would just, and I said, I would say to him, bone cancer in children? What are you thinking of? Whole villages wiped out by a volcano? I mean, if you really want to push it, you can say that a hurricane that kills people might be a result of human warming of the planet, but a volcano is just the way the world was made by you, Mr. God. Mm. And why, if you're all the powerful, you could have made a world that didn't have that and that didn't have special insects whose whole life cycle is to bury themselves into children's eyes where they lay eggs and cause them to go blind. You could have made a world without that.
Yeah.
You could have made a world in which Auschwitz was impossible, in which starvation of children is impossible, in which cruelty and the desire to hurt didn't exist. And it wouldn't make us all zombies, because you could have decided it didn't. So, I mean, it's quite a difficult argument to confront if you do believe in this loving God, because you've just got to say, well, he decided that he'd test us. Well, what kind of sadist would do that?
And why wasn't I born with all these cool tattoos? I've had to go through a lot of pain to get these. They look great. I'm really happy with them. It would have been a lot easier if they were there when it started.
That's an excellent point.
But I think the more I kind of learn and develop, the more crucial fluidity seems to be in our development as a species, as a people. And I think we're at a really tough time where we don't have that. Again, like, it doesn't have to be religious is nonsense or religious is right. There should be a fluidity there. And I remember early days of Twitter, when you were more active, reveling in your responses when there would be some kind of outrage about a particular kind of slang, or someone has used language in a particular way, and someone very pompous would jump up and say that they're destroying the English language and things like that. And you'd come out and say, like, language develops. Like, I can't remember the last time I said forsooth. It's been a while. Things have developed and things change, and that's what slang is part of. And I think that's important, right? Particularly with someone who loves language as much as yourself.
You're so right, and I think your use of the word fluidity is an excellent one. I try and express something of the same feeling by saying, you know, a favourite thought of mine is that there are no nouns in the universe. Everything's a verb. Everything is happening. It's nothing is frozen. Language is the most obvious example in some ways. It is constantly adapting and changing and moving and flowing, and all the better for it. And, I mean, it's like evolution. You know, it's like sort of if an animal behaves in a certain way, you can't say, you can't behave like that. You're a frog and frogs don't do that. Well, that animal is adapting its behavior. That's what life means. And what language means is words adapting to new circumstances and so on and so forth. And you're absolutely right. But it's particularly true, I think, of our own attitudes, our own, whatever we want to call it, morality or set of values, and is that the, I won't say fatal, it's a bit strong, but I've always been terrified of settling on a series of principles and ethics and moral tenets that I have to cling on to, and that is what I believe. Without getting too sort of existentialist, I like the idea of waking up in the morning and discovering what I feel and think about the world, and that it might change and it might be different. I suppose there are core values, if one wants to call them that, that are bound to be to do with a dislike and fear and revulsion at giving pain or at suffering generally, and of course a woebegone feeling of inadequacy as to how one responds to that. And one knows that's, you know, just like, you know, we all know how urgent it is to try and attend to the climate crisis, but are we really doing enough? Yeah. Animals are suffering everywhere. Are we doing enough? Children are dying, not getting educated. Are we doing enough? I mean, you could drive yourself insane by the feelings of inadequacy you have in your contribution to alleviating suffering, and you can wonder whether one is, am I a hypocrite for just thinking, oh, I'll lay off my carbon like that because I can afford to. I can lay off this here. I can contribute to this charity here. Now I'm a good person. That doesn't really square, does it? You don't feel like that. because, as you say, it's fluid. Life is, you know, you're constantly journeying towards trying to achieve a certain kind of, well, you don't want to feel pleased with yourself, but nor do you want to feel the opposite. You don't want to feel constantly angry, pissed off that am I the best me I can be and all, yeah, all those sort of phrases, you know. And I think the great thing is just to be okay with that. And you talk about fluidity, and that takes us back to that great 60s phrase, go with the flow.
Yeah.
I try not to get upset about things as if they are therefore fixed. Ah, that means dot, dot, dot. Because nothing means dot, dot, dot. It's tending towards it, but we can steer it away. You know,
yeah.
That's because it's a flow, you can steer.
I've in recent years, and it's still a work in progress, I'm trying more and more to move away from the way we've built, again, our society around actions always being based on results. And
yes.
And what I mean by that is trying to, like, again, I used to do speak a lot politically. I've backed down a lot on that now because I think what I can do is live my life in the way I think should, yeah, be right. And the pandemic has been a prime example of that. I think the UK, America and several other places have handled it absolutely appallingly. The impact on the rest of the world isn't being kind of talked about enough. But rather than get angry at people, I've tried to make sure I've just lived how I should. I've stayed home as much as I can. I've worn my mask and so on and so forth. And you'll speak to people and they'll say, yeah, but if everyone else is doing it, what difference are you going to make? So, well, no, it's not about me making a difference. Not everything should be, well, I do this to get this result. There should be an element of, I do this because I think this is the right thing to be doing at this,
yes,
time. And I can balance this with myself rather than I'm going to make the big difference that changes everything. You know?
Yes, exactly. Because it's a mixture of arrogance and naivety to imagine that,
yeah,
one can change things in any other way than, in a sense, but one can help by, you know, contributing to a conversation, if you like. But I sometimes wonder, and this can almost seem like a callous thought, but people talk, you know, intellectuals and so on, talk about what they call an epistemic crisis, which means a crisis in knowledge. Mm. In other words, knowledge is not valued as it was. There is no authority, no proper source of knowledge. Everything is challenged. So even scientific consensus can be just, I don't agree. And I'm not going to wear this. I don't think, you know, or, you know, finding excuses for thinking that doctors and nurses and medical professors are somehow either in the pay of big pharma, or they're just deluded, or they have some political agenda, which can range from something quite mild to the extremes of the conspiracy theories that we all know about. And that is regarded as the epistemic crisis, this crisis that there is no agreed basis of knowledge anymore. But there's, you could also say it's an epistemic crisis because we just know too much. That a few hundred years ago, for example, and this is why it might sound callous, there could be an earthquake in Turkey and no one in England would know about it.
Yeah.
For months. And then eventually there'd be, oh, did you hear in Ankara or something, 3,000 people died. You go, oh, that's a shame. Oh. But now it happens in real time almost. I mean, mm-hmm. literally you hear CNN and the Sky News and people saying, and bringing you the news as it happens. And I always want to say, well, could you bring it just slightly after it's happened, please? Otherwise,
yeah,
you could intervene and stop it happening. If,
yeah,
it has.
Yeah.
but, you know, so, and I remember a character in the Nabokov novel, like, I think, is it Pale Fire? I can't remember. Or The Real Life of Sebastian Knight. Anyway, it doesn't matter what the title of the book was. But he's a character who has this kind of sensitivity to what happens in history. So a friend finds him crying, and he's crying about a battle in China that was incredibly cruel, and thousands of people died horribly, and children and women. And he's reading about it. And the fellow goes, where did this happen? And he says, where? And he says, and when did you get the news? He said, well, it's in this book. It happened in, you know, the year 1213. He said, oh! The fellow says, I thought this had recently happened. Well, why are you so upset? And he says, well, I'm upset because people 1,000 years ago suffered.
Yeah.
You're upset when people 1,000 miles away suffer. Why shouldn't I be upset because it's 1,000 years ago? Why should the distance in time mean less than the distance in miles. They're all fellow humans and they suffer. The fact that they're not suffering literally now is not the point. And it's kind of weird. It just makes you think a little. And
yeah, of how things impact us and why they impact us. It's really interesting.
And I grew up in the rural wilds of Norfolk, and it, you know, it really was pretty. I mean, there were people I met who one person I met had never even been to Norwich, but most of the people in the villages around had certainly never been to London.
Yeah.
And they didn't follow news. The only news they followed was that you had to be a bit careful sometimes. I remember once walking along this, I say street, a lane in a little village, and I was listening to the cricket on a National Panasonic transistor radio. That was my favourite little thing. And an old boy came up with a stick and rather expertly whipped it out of my hand and next to my ear, where it clattered and broke on the pavement. And I was absolutely astonished. It was just like this 70-year-old man had just attacked me and broken my radio. And then he started talking about the Japanese, and he'd been a prisoner of war in wow. the Japanese. And the Norfolk Regiment had been one of the worst affected by the Changi Railway and all the horrors of being a prisoner of war of the Japanese camps then, and Burma Railway or whatever. And so they... It was quite common back in the 60s and 70s to see Japanese cars being kicked and wow. that happening to me. So that was a strange thing. But apart from that, it was interesting to grow up in such a rural community where there was absolutely no interest in the rest of the world, or in politics particularly. It was all gossip about, gossip makes it sound cheap, but it was stories about, oh, have you heard Mrs. So-and-so's had a baby, or have you heard that they were this or that, or, you know. And that was enough to keep everybody talking, everybody interested. And if someone in the pub or whatever, while there was a dark game going on, started to talk about gender or about left and right, the people would stare at them as if they were insane. They just got on with their lives. And the fact that there were storms blowing around the world, there was, I guess at the time, there was the Vietnam War and there was Watergate and goodness knows what else, and some people were regarding the world as going to hell in a handcart, or to hell in a Bonham Carter, as I call it. it just, as I say, it's sort of callous and it's impossible now. But a part of me thinks, how wonderful if we all just got on with our lives without noticing what everyone else was up to, and just concentrating on those close around us, as you say, and our own lives and thoughts, and not exactly not giving a shit, but just not bother. You know, just that's enough for all humans to concentrate, just as animals do. Yeah. And there was an experiment that I think was run by that now rather discredited but fascinating man, B.F. Skinner, who was the sort of leading light of behavioural science for many years in the 40s and 50s, right up until he was basically humiliated by Chomsky, but that's another story. But if you put a load of mice in a glass or Perspex tray, shallow Perspex tray, and put it in the water, they run around randomly and the tray stays afloat. But if you scale it up to humans, he couldn't get it to stay afloat for more than about 2 seconds.
Wow.
Because humans have the problem of consciousness and knowing.
Yeah.
So they see they're tipping one way and they all run the other way to compensate, and they overcompensate and the thing capsizes.
Yeah.
But the mice don't know anything. They just get on with being mice. And so the kind of Brownian motion of their scurrying backwards and forwards keeps the thing on an even keel.
Wow.
Now, I don't want to establish a political system based on B.F. Skinner's mice, but it sort of speaks to what I was saying about if you just forget this, forget the world.
Mm.
You know, the poet Wordsworth, whom I think more and more as I get older, was an extraordinarily wise and profound poet. You know, he's so easy just to think of daffodils and the countryside and so on. But in one of his sonnets, it begins very famously with, "The world is too much with us, getting and spending." And that simple thought, the world is too much with us. And what should be with us is our friends, our families, those we care about, you know, our immediate circle, our sense of our own fulfillment and what we can do to make those we see every day happier and cheerful and become friends and look after. But to think that we're basically helping the world by squawking about huge abstract things that we have no... It's basically being like King Lear and yelling at the storm. Blow yeah. winds and crack your cheeks, you know. And he was mad.
It's, I think the another part of it is, obviously, we've not got the capacity to take in every problem in the world.
No.
But all we hear about are the crushingly sad things around the world or the infuriating things around the world. And there's been points where my partner has become kind of overwhelmed by it, when there was, particularly last year, when there was so much going on in America and all sorts of just horrible racism and loads of other violence. And I kind of said, and this sounds like it's dumbing it down so much, but you've got to bear in mind that there's probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of kids who've tasted ice cream for the first time today.
Yes,
and we can't know that. We can't hear about that. There is so much good going on in the world, but the bad is magnified because it needs to be addressed. So we need to, at points, try and balance out and go, or, you know, there's millions of dogs whose owners have just come home and they're so happy and excited to see them. And these aren't the things that we bring upon ourselves when opening, as you say, our timelines and scrolling through other people's...
Mm.
Rage, I guess. So
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I take these ideas for a walk, as it were. I'm really not saying we shouldn't ever concern ourselves with the fate of the world and
of course.
You know, the big things. But there is just a sense that maybe we could, you know, spend more time privileging that which is close to us and the, as you say, the happy moments and the living life within the sphere of a normal animal.
You spoke of news being brought live as it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I wanted to talk a little bit about, if it's okay, we did postpone one of our podcast chats a while back, and I found out why when you put out a hugely moving and emotional video about your battle with prostate cancer. And I emailed you immediately about it because I just thought you handled it so perfectly and really addressed it honestly and openly. But you did do it kind of beautifully. You went through it the way you needed to. And privately, and then when you were ready, rather than the need nowadays for everything to be this public, particularly if you're in the public eye, everything has to be a public journey. And I thought that was beautiful. What was the kind of, the choice and thought process?
It was exactly
how
that.
Are you, I guess?
I was quite, you know, once you sit in that chair opposite a consultant who says, well, yes, the tests are, as we suspected, I'm afraid it is cancer. When you hear those words, which you've kind of prepared for all your life, because we've all put ourselves in that chair, imagining what it would be like. How would I respond? Would I be noble and brave? Would my bottom lip quiver? Would I sob? Would I scream, no, you're wrong, check again, or whatever? But of all the thoughts that crowded me, one that was pretty clear early on was that I didn't want to go through the procedures and the various treatments and whatever that would be thrown at me and that I would undergo. I didn't want to do them in real time with the public. That would just be too distracting. I wanted, because you mentioned it as saying that it was a battle, and I've tried always to avoid that word as much as a tip of the cap to my dear departed friend Christopher Hitchens, the journalist who wrote a wonderful article called The Topic of Cancer when he had esophageal cancer, which took him, and saying, you know, the one thing it isn't is a battle, and it just plain isn't.
Right.
It's an ongoing thing. It never, you know, once you've had it, the chances are you're always going to have to be, as I am, tested. I was tested just, you know, the other week again, and I'm just awaiting and the results of another one, because these, you know, there's always the possibility of a few cells of hell around. But the one thing you do is you submit to those who know what they're doing. You submit to a surgeon, a urologist, a doctor, a nurse, all the people around you who know exactly what they're doing. You don't want to get in their way.
How was that? As someone who's had such agency over your career and your choices and from podcasts to audiobooks, as said, having the ability to record audiobooks in your house, having such control over your life, to have to go, this is something that is out of my control. This is something I have to hand control over to someone else.
It's almost a relief, really.
Yeah.
Just to say, okay, what's the best thing I can do is what you say to them. What do you need me to do?
Yeah.
And, they'll say, they'll try and say, don't worry. I know enough about, I have a typical sort of amateur scholar of the body's, interest in various things. And I know enough about, cortisol and stress hormones and so on to know that if one is anxious and feeling stressed and not relaxed, it actually is clinically bad for you, whatever your disease, whatever condition you might be in. One of the pleasing things that's developed in medicine over the past 20 years or so is that now doctors and surgeons and nurses are taught much more about eye contact and maybe laying a hand on someone's arm, explaining things to them in a friendly, warm way, making them feel utterly relaxed and cared for, that those have, rather than the old patriarchal bow-tied doctor saying, we'll soon have you on your feet, Mr. Fry, and all that.
Yeah.
They're much more your friend. And that is, it's not political correctness or wokeness. It is clinically very sound. So basically my job was to relax and not worry, which is a peculiar thing to say, but that's it's not a battle. It's not, how would you battle it? It's something you can't see. It's a disruption of cells way down in some part of your body you're not even aware of particularly.
Not aware that it's in a battle. It's
just doing what it does. Exactly.
That's the thing that gets me. I struggle a lot. Like having had people go through cancer and leukemia and other things, I completely understand the cancer research kind of, we're going to beat this, we're all going to run and all this, but I struggle personally with the personification of it as this thing that we've all got to fight. It doesn't care that you've done a march or a walk or whatever else.
You're right. It's kind of, it's almost giving it more power to demonize it like that.
Yeah,
cancer becomes this kind of ghoul.
I understand it, because particularly in those moments you want that enemy and you want that, we're going to do something about it, because it is so out of your control, as you say.
Sometimes, you're absolutely right, sometimes giving a name to your pain, as it were, is a very good idea, and it can be a battle. And I would say I definitely had a battle, and I gave it a name when I gave up smoking, 15 years ago, whenever it was. That there, you think of someone you really dislike. You just can't bear, it could be a journalist or a politician or whatever it is, and they are in your stomach or somewhere around your duodenum, your diaphragm, and they want you to have a cigarette.
Mm.
And every time you breathe in like that, they go, yes, and they get a bit bigger and a bit stronger.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And every time you say, no, I'm not going to have the cigarette now, they go, no, have it, go on, have it. They go, no. No, Piers Morgan, or whatever you've decided to call this creature inside you, I'm not going to give you that. I'm going to, and it will waste away. I mean, that's
amazing. Yeah,
that was my psychological thing. Plus,
yeah.
Plus, I took a pill called Champix, which may have been helpful too. But anything you can do in those circumstances, because there you are fighting something that is kind of part of you, addiction. I don't know if you've ever been an addict, but that is obviously a big issue in our world, and I think that is a battle in a sense. It sort of has to be, doesn't it? You can't submit to giving up something. You have to take up arms to defeat it.
Again, the language is always bizarre to me, because giving up something doesn't sound like a positive. The giving up as a term, it sounds like it's a negative. It's like, right, no,
that's true.
I've given up slowly killing myself.
Yes, but I suppose it would sound a bit sort of fey to say I'm embracing life. Find some other phrase.
Yeah. Well, I could talk to you for hours, Stephen. Obviously,
yes,
but I don't
want to
take up too much of your time, so I'll start to wrap things up. But I guess I want to know what's ahead. I love when you do your podcast series, but I get a huge excitement when you pop up on TV in things like It's a Sin, which was just absolutely amazing piece of work last year. What is the plan? Is acting a focus? Is your own writing?
I'd hate to give up acting. I mean, I'm sort of quite aware that, in a sense, I burned my acting boats many years ago. In that, I love acting, and I may be wrong to think that I could have concentrated on just that. But I've presented myself as myself in things like QI so much that I have to be very careful about what sort of role I pick. And indeed, I guess people have to be very careful about what they cast me as, because you, especially in Britain, you don't want people to go, well, there's Stephen Fry, what's he doing? You know, they're not, in a strange way, they're not seeing the role. But if it's the right kind of role, like in It's a Sin, which I felt, you know, playing a Tory MP, closeted Tory MP somehow, was in my wheelhouse, as Americans like to say. And I've done a couple of, last year I did a Netflix series called The Sandman, which is coming out in about a month or so.
Can't wait for that. Neil Gaiman is a dear friend.
He's a genius,
and just his adaptations to TV so far have been perfect. Yeah, his involvement in them really.
Yeah, I love American Gods. It hasn't been covered enough, I don't think, American Gods. I just love it, with Ian McShane as fabulous as Wednesday, as the Odin character.
Yeah.
So there's that. And I also did, I played. A wonderful role. I mean, a sad role, but very interesting. In Hulu, which is a Disney streaming entity. I don't know. Can you get Hulu in England? I'm not sure.
I don't think so. I think most of the stuff comes on other
It does. So it'll come on Sky Atlantic or something, I dare say. But it's called The Dropout, and it's the story of Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos.
Right.
And while we were filming it, she was on trial up in San Francisco. And we were in Hollywood making this with Amanda Seyfried playing her.
Wow.
And a lovely cast with, William H. Macy and Waterston and people like that. And Sam Waterston. And I played the scientist in it. And I really enjoyed doing that. So that's coming out, I think, in a couple of weeks in America. But when it's coming out here, I'm not sure. So there are a few things like that, which I love. And I'm doing a couple of documentaries. I've got one coming out, I think, on the 28th of February. It's called Fantastic Beasts. And it's the idea is to relate all the very popular, fabled creatures like mermaids and dragons and unicorns, which mean so much to children these days. Dinosaurs, dragons are dinosaurs, essentially. Yeah. To find out where they came from, why do dragons exist in cultures all over the world and have done for thousands of years? Similarly, mermaids and unicorns and what they mean and so on. And I really enjoyed that. It involved a bit of filming in America and in Scotland and in England. And I'm also doing a documentary called A Year on Planet Earth, which is a marvellously ambitious four-part documentary, one for each season, which ITV are doing. They haven't been in the natural history space, as I suppose one should call it, for many years, quite rightly leaving it to the Natural History Unit in Bristol and the magnificence that is David Attenborough. But they just felt that this was an interesting story or way of telling it. And in fact, I'm going next week to Iceland to do some filming on it, and then to Mexico.
Oh wow!
So I'm keeping busy. I'm happy to say, I'm very lucky.
Yeah, they all sound fantastic. As I sit here opposite me, I've got a kind of artist rendition of a rhinoceros's head on my wall, and underneath it, I have a plaque that says a unicorn, because I believe rhinoceroses are the reality of unicorns.
In fact,
there's the fantasy, and then the reality is these wonderful beasts that don't fit this white, svelte version of what a unicorn should be, but they're glorious all the same.
And in fact, the Indian rhinoceros, which is the one that looks really armor plated, almost in the most kind of wrinkle, that is called Unicornis. Is its
amazing.
Its Latinate name? And there was there were other predecessors to the rhinoceros that were even larger, with huge single horns, and they did overlap with human beings as well.
Yeah.
And the other thing that people don't think about is, at least I didn't, I mustn't assume everyone is dumb as that, as dumb as me in that regard, but it's easy to think that we only as it were, discovered dinosaurs in the 19th century when ladies in long skirts in Lyme Regis found fossils and scientists in London said, and worked out what these creatures were. But of course, for thousands of years, human beings have been walking the planet and we've seen these stone bones poke up through the ground. And there are places in, for example, I went to Utah, the Cleveland Lloyd Dinosaur Quarry, which is the largest Jurassic collection of fossils in the world. And they're open, you know. So, and the local people, the Utes, the local indigenous peoples before the Europeans came, would have seen these and used them as clubs and things. And what it... They had no data to suggest that these were the bones of animals that had been extinct for millions of years. Yeah. As far as they were concerned, they could be living in a mountain around the corner or in a cave somewhere.
Yeah.
And that's true around the world. So that you can see a little bit of how the dragon might have come about in that regard. It's really fascinating.
Completely. I can't wait to watch all of it, and I'm glad we finally got to sit down and chat. I'm not a spiritual person, but one of the few things I do always feel is that these conversations, they happen when they were meant to, and it feels like it was the perfect time to talk now. So that's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Pip. Loved it.
Thank you for allowing me to question Stephen Fryers, as yes, as it were.
You did what thou shouldst not do. Stephen Fry. Thou shalt not question Stephen Fry. Thou shalt not question Stephen Fry. Thou shalt not question Stephen Fry. Thou shalt not question
Stephen Fry. You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Stephen Fry. I told you it was a good one. I told you. I felt he did me some favours in that episode as well. There was a few things where I brought up a subject that I had a surface level amount of knowledge on, and he jumped on it and gave the complete history of as if I already knew it, which made me look far cleverer than I actually am. So, yeah, you heard the joy in my voice throughout that. I loved talking to Stephen. He's been so gracious with me over the years in interactions, and I'm so glad we got to sit down and finally have this chat. As I said, if this is your first time, head into the back catalogue. I'm trying to think of people I didn't mention in the first one. I've had Ramesh Ranganathan on numerous times, Emmy Award-winning Brett Goldstein. Recently, amazing chats with Lucy Pinder, Ivana Lynch, Emma DeBiri, Kelechi Okafor, end of last year, Edgar Wright. Loads of really good people. Essentially, go to whatever your favourite podcast platform is and type Distraction Pieces, and then any name that comes to mind, and chances are they've been on. If not, if you just type Distraction Pieces, I think most platforms will give you the most listened to few episodes or whatever. I was thinking I've not listed many musicians. I've had Fatboy Slim on. I've had Roots Maneuver on. I've had Frank Carter, Frank Turner, both the Franks, all the Franks, Billy Bragg. I've had Russell Kane, Russell Brand and Russell Howard, all the Russells. I've had Alan Moore. I've had Neil Gaiman. I've had some amazing people, essentially. So jump in that back catalogue and have a good swim about. And enjoy yourself. Gail Porter, that was an amazing episode. It was a two-parter. It was really good. Stephen Graham, I've had him on loads of times. I'm going to stop listing people that have been on the podcast because this is annoying even for me. But yeah, if you enjoyed it, go and check them out. And I'll be back next week with more podcasts. I've put out a podcast every week for the last 8 years, so it ain't stopping anytime soon. We may have peaked. We may have just peaked with Stephen Fry, but let's see. Let's keep going. We can still do better. So I'll be back next week. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta. Oh, and follow me on Twitch. twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio. Peace.
Hold up. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.